I'm very pleased to introduce our next speaker, Jim Gamble. Jim is a former head of the Online Protection Service, CEOP, and he was with them for several years. Before that, he's done a variety of had a variety of positions in law enforcement, having been a deputy chief constable, having headed up counter-terrorism in Northern Ireland, and various other positions that he's adopted. But child protection was something that he took to his heart, both nationally and internationally, when he came to CEOP, and he's now very well versed in that and very passionate about it. And now, since he left CEOP, after a discussion with the Home Secretary, he has his own organisation delivering protective services, policy solutions and technical solutions by way of apps, which of course is the future, and we're hoping very much to do some work with Jim. So without any further ado, Jim Gamble.
Can everybody hear me, or do I need to stand behind the microphone? Anybody can't hear me? That's a pity. I was going to say, if there was a spot at the back, you might want to move there now. What I intend to do, you've had all the experts on today, and really, someone said to me recently, didn't you used to be Jim Gamble? You used to be the guy. And I said, yes, I used to be him. He was a very difficult character. But now that, you know, Theresa and I have had a parting of the ways and we don't share Christmas cards anymore, I'm much more mellow than I was before. And in fact, if I was ever constrained about what I said because of my position within a statutory agency, then of course those constraints are now lifted. So I can really say pretty much what I want. I think one of the problems was that pretty much I always said what I wanted anyway. And in a world where those that work in the field of child protection aren't given the respect that they do or the recognition for the difficulty of the job that they do, the extraordinary difficult job that is complex, that is complicated, that, you know, that complexity has been added to by the advent of the internet and new technology. In a world where child protection is not seen in the way that it should, it's sometimes good to be able to reflect and argue with government. Because my point with Theresa May, whenever I left, was simply this. If you can't explain to me why you think what you're going to do is better for children, if you can't even begin to explain it, then you have to accept that I'm duty-bound to challenge you. Because Lord Lamy, in his update report after the death of baby Peter, said, one of the faults is that we become so involved in being good partners. We want to be good friends. We don't want to fall out with anyone. So actually, the partnership and the multi-agency work became more important than the inter-agency challenge, than the individual agency expertise. So if I was going to attend universities and talk to budding young social workers, or police colleges and talk to young police constables about to go out and deliver that critical frontline protection, I would be a real hypocrite. I said to them, you must challenge across agency and up within your own. If I didn't say to the Home Secretary, I think you're wrong. I think you're absolutely wrong, and I'm going to challenge you, and it will come to one of two things. Either you will sack me, or I will resign if we don't reconcile the issue. So, that just goes to prove that I haven't left that baggage behind. But everybody brings their baggage with them. Everybody does. Now, let's just go back a short while. So it's not that long ago that the internet didn't exist. And I like the way we've done all this today, because we have that cycle of learning. And in an education establishment, we love cycles of learning. I'll give you the cycle within the police service. How many of my former colleagues in the British Police Service are here today? 1, 2, 3. It was great when I was still serving. I could kind of impose an embargo on questions, but no, I can't. We have this cycle, and if you want to disagree with me, you can. And it goes a little bit from ignorance to arrogance to developed understanding. And in the police, maybe like other organizations, we fear that of which we're ignorant. So when computers first started appearing, we did like schools. You know, Colin's in here. Maybe he's going to heckle me later in revenge. But we did like schools. We said, no, you can't use that Cyan personal organizer. My God. Someone might break through the small encryption on it and find out what you said. We'd far prefer you use that big file of facts that you leave at your ass in the back of the car Someone then finds it, opens it, no extra precaution, and realises immediately it's the direct addresses of all of these police officers in Northern Ireland who are now going to have to move. And never worry about that because the taxpayers can pick up the bill. So you have that point of absolute ignorance, when really we fear it because we don't understand it. Now, we then move on to arrogance. And as an ex-police officer of many years, let me tell you, we knew arrogance very, very well. You know the difference between God and the chief constable? God doesn't think he's a chief constable. It's true. And the truth is, if you've ever been stopped by someone, like a traffic police officer, you know, when we've got you in that circumstance, we knew arrogance particularly well, because you're in trouble. And in my experience, that's when you switch on the humble button. I'm very sorry. You know, I didn't realise that was a speed limit. In the police service, the way that manifests itself is the competitive nature that you see between the far too many small charities that are out there competing against one another in similar fees. It's unhealthy. You know, our computers had to be different than the police force next door. You know, we wanted them to be better and smarter because they were ours. And God forbid that they could talk to the police service next door, that we could exchange information, because information is power. And when you're in the service, it's all about the power that your organisation has. And I'm exaggerating and characterising, but that's the truth. It was only when you've got cases like Holly and Jessica that come along that you realise the tragic consequence of organisational or individual ego, whether it's the police, the health service or anywhere else, that doesn't allow the advances in modern technology to benefit information sharing at the right time, in the right place, about the right issue, whether it's domestic violence, child abuse, or anything else. So what happens with us, and happened with us in the past, I still say us, within the police service, was that we had to have our nose kind of held to the grindstone through that cycle till we began to learn, till the reviews came out and said we must improve, the Bishar review about sharing information. And we're all scared to share information. One of the things that fundamentally undermines child protection, the protection of the vulnerable, is the fact that we're not empowered to share. We don't feel empowered to share. If I turn up a casualty with non-accidental injury, as a woman who's been there 4 or 5 months in succession, it takes a very courageous nurse at A&E to go and tell someone that I think this is a victim of domestic violence. And the fact of the matter is, health have always had issues about sharing information. I was the police member on the 3-panel homicide review, the first ever domestic homicide review, dealing with the murder of Julia Pember, a lady who was terrorised and tortured by her husband until one day he turned up and murdered their son in the front garden, broke into the house while she hid in the cupboard on the phone to the police, and she was eventually murdered. Now, at the end of the day, the truth is, did we share information properly? When we brought people in to question them as part of the first serious case review, the first domestic homicide review, I spoke to some people in the broader statutory services, in health, who said, well, I've never come across a case of domestic violence before. Now, I've been doing this for 20-odd years. And you think, for 20 years, you've been sitting blind. So sharing information is critically important. Protecting the vulnerable is critically important. So we in the police went through a cycle where we had to learn about the mistakes that we made. And I'm saying that because if you cannot share information, you cannot protect people properly. Google sat here this morning and I thought Google were very good. I think it would be even better if Google were still here now. I think that would be much better. I think it would be much better if Facebook were still here now. Because sitting at the front and presenting the veneer of your organisation, I'm always going to present the veneer of whatever I do, because you know what, it's good. And whenever I was a CEO, I like to turn up, I like to be controversial, and I like to leave straight away. Because then you don't have to answer any of the questions. You don't have to linger over those difficult ones about where did you get those statistics from? They are really unusual. It's only 10% of young people bullied on the internet. My goodness, I want to see that statistic, because that doesn't feel right to me. It just doesn't feel, it doesn't reflect the experience that I've had. But Google were here, and I tell you something, if I could change one thing in social care today, it would be that we would all use Google+. We would use Google+, the social networking platform, and we would use it to virally share information about the cases we were dealing with all the time. Why? because it's a far better system than anything we have within the criminal justice or the broader social care provision. You drop one piece of information into a Google Plus circle, if that is your child protection team looking after a particularly vulnerable baby, because the midwife's been in and realises there's a new man in the house, and you know what, doesn't really like the look of him or the sound of him or the behaviour that he's demonstrating. That's immediately shared with everybody else within that circle, within that link. So they don't wait for the case conference, they don't wait for the phone call. They're immediately alerted to the fact that in case A145, because we've anonymised it, we have someone at risk. We have someone who we've now alerted everyone to. So the police can't say, well, it's just a pity they didn't tell us that, because we had intervened much earlier. Sharing information. So I'll come back on message. Where we are is important. But it's important to look back before you move forward. And looking back, there were some myths talked about this morning. And there's a lot of truth in what was said, that there are a lot of myths out there. So let me give you a definition of the internet. And that definition of the internet should be how you make judgments about what you do and how you do it, the services you deliver, and how you protect the young and vulnerable. And the easiest way to define the internet is to use this room. This room is the internet. When it's empty, it's neutral. It's defined in character by the bums on the seat at this moment in time. The internet is defined in character. The internet is low risk or high risk, dependent upon the people that occupy a particular space in that environment at any given moment in time. The internet is the most fabulous gift that we've ever been given, next perhaps to life itself. Because we're able to learn, we're able to share, we're able to engage, we're able to reduce social exclusion. If we properly educate and empower young people, and we integrate that learning from the earliest stage with teacher training, so that teachers are fundamental when it comes to demonstrating by what they do, not what they say, by what they do with the use of social media, with new technology, in their private lives and in their professional lives. They set examples and become mentors. They become the people that we aspire to be in the class. It's a fabulous position of responsibility. So you've got to think differently when we think about the use of social media. So the internet is simply a platform that of itself is neutral. Now, I've said this in many places, and somebody who calls himself, I think, an IT lawyer or something on a blog, and that's great. We used to have the mad, the bad, and the sad in criminology. Now we have the geeks, freaks, and morons who occupy the internet and hide behind the anonymity that it brings to be much braver souls than they actually are in reality. Because I had all of that lovely troll stuff when I did the Madeleine McCann review. You know, what kind of man names his two daughters after murder victims? My daughter is called Holly and Jessica. Holly's 28, a special needs teacher, and Jessica's 20, studying in Northumbria as a social worker. Now, to think that I named them after Holly and Jessica, murder victims and so on, is pretty outrageous. But people, when they're protected by the anonymity, will say anything. But this one chap was offended because he was in a group that I was speaking to when I said, you know, the truth is this. This room is like the internet. It's defined in character by the people that occupy the places at any time. Most of you will be very decent people. Some of you will be liars. Some of you will be cheats. Some of you pretend to be much nicer than you really are. I'm one of those ones. In fact, someone said to me, you don't do a very good job at it because you don't seem very nice ever. And, you know, I accept that's pretty true as well. But some of you will go home at night and beat your partners. Some of you will be abusive in an audience of a reasonable size. And in an audience of a reasonable size, there'll always be one person, perhaps, may have an inappropriate interest in children. Maybe more. Now, they were personally offended because they said I'd accused everyone of being a paedophile. I'm not accusing everyone of being a paedophile. What I'm saying is, if you don't open your eyes to the fact that we're all human and we bring with us all of those flaws, then actually you're probably a high-risk person to be involved in child protection if you think because of the uniform a person wears or the position in society that they hold, and that they could never think of it, that it could never be them. So, dealing with that, the other myth is, you know, when it comes to children in the online environment and these images, that it's only looking. I was only looking. I really, you know, control my desires because I know it's not right. And I look at these pictures, and that's all I need. You know, there's a technical legal phrase called liar, liar, pants on fire. And the truth is this, only looking. If you were to look at my internet history, you'd see that I was only looking at a lot of travel websites. And you might assume from that I'm going to go on holiday, and you're right, I am. Now, there's lots of things that I'll look at online, and you know what they do? They generally reflect the interests that I have in the real world, because I then take those with me into the virtual world, because it's one and the same life. And when I spoke at Oxford a couple of years ago, an American doctor at the back put her hand up and said, look, why don't you concentrate on the real problem? Paedophiles in the real world who will access young children, who will get them on these modelling sites, who will get them on Facebook or elsewhere where they're being groomed and take them into the real world and where there's real abuse. Now, I suppose that's a legitimate question. And my response to her was, well, I'll tell you what. Let's imagine, and use your imagination here, that I'm only 27. Full head of hair, one chin and no bellies. And ultimately, I live next door to you with my mother. And I babysit for your children, Mrs. Doctor from America. And you come out on Monday and my mum is very upset. You say, Mrs. Campbell, what's wrong? She says, well, it's been a terrible mistake. Jim has been arrested. He doesn't have an interest in children. He just looks at these child abuse images on the internet. The lucky thing is I get out on police bail on Wednesday morning. So come Wednesday night, I'm knocking the door with the video, the sweets, you know, I'm here to babysit for your children. And I said to her, are you going to leave me with them? Are you and your husband going to go out? Because I always babysit on Wednesday night for your 7-year-old and your 11-year-old. And all I was doing was looking. Now, of course, she said quite rightly that wasn't a fair question. And it wasn't. But it's the only question, because when it comes to children in the online environment, when it comes to risk to them, who gets the benefit of the doubt? The 27-year-old who's been downloading images, or the two children that should not be left alone with them. And the difficulty is, I don't want you to think that I'm saying the internet creates paedophiles, because it doesn't. I worked in London for 10 years between the National Crime Squad and SEOP. And for the 6 years of SEOP, I used to walk along the Pimlico Road every day. And on the Pimlico Road, there used to be a photographer's shop, Henry Haler Photographers. And Henry was raided by the Metropolitan Police. And when the Metropolitan Police raided his premises, they found 132,000 images of young people that he had collected, many his own 12-year-old sons. And the interesting thing was Henry kept these images on glass. Does anyone know why? Because Henry Haler was raided in 1872. In 1872, Henry Haler had all of these images of children that he had captured and put on glass. People do these things. Technology doesn't. The technology itself is neutral. When we talk about children in the online environment, we talk about children in the media, who do you think the biggest publisher of images of children is in the online environment? Children. Self-generated. Self-published. So you don't deal with that issue by arresting everybody. You don't deal with that issue by forcing it into the criminal justice system. You educate and empower them to make better decisions. Most young people are fabulous. They have, to a large degree, even with all of the stuff that's going on, an innocence and a potential, if given the right support at the right time in the right place, to do great things. We should no more suggest that they don't use social media or don't use new technology than we would that they shouldn't go into the library or learn to read and write in case they see something or read something that they shouldn't. It's about educating and empowering them to make the right decisions at the right time in their lives. It's about building social media policy in schools that says, you know, what are the parameters? Because we want young people to use the technology that they have. We want them to be able to broadcast with the appropriate informed consent those things where we achieve an ethical mutual benefit. The school, the parents, the pupils. There isn't a paedophile on every street corner. And if we got one thing wrong in the past, it was probably allowing that to build the impression that you can't go online without bumping into a paedophile. Because that's just not true. We need to empower and engage them. The bad news is that there's a generation that are lost. When we began this journey, back in 2003, perhaps 2004, we were all ignorant. The generation of parents didn't understand it. The good news is this next generation have grown up with a lot of it. So they use it more intuitively. They've evolved with it. they're able to use it more effectively. And they don't go out trying to get themselves hurt, generally. Some people are vulnerable, but some people, by the use of social media, can become socially included in a way that they never could in the real world by and of itself. So building that social media policy that is informed, as the group I was in earlier on were talking about, and Colin led, about informed by the young people themselves, by the community within which the school sits, by the parents, by the teachers, by the staff in the school. Which bits do we want for information sharing? Which bits do we want to use? Imagine you go on a school trip. Is it a good or a bad thing that all your kids are on Facebook? I personally think it's a good thing. Now, and I've dealt with cases where the guy in the raincoat, of course, isn't wearing a raincoat, turns up, you know, at Millbank because he knows that the little girl is going to be there because he's been talking to her online and she's going to the Tate. But actually, if one of your kids goes missing and they've signed up with the appropriate parental consent, and if they're a fan on a page that you have, not on your personal page, but even for that trip, you're then able to use the geolocation services to ascertain where they are and where their phone is for that short period of time. Is that a good thing or a bad thing? Technology can be used in any way. Now, it's a bad thing if you're a domestic violence perpetrator and I've logged on and I can check my ex-partner's phone. It's about policy. It's about shaping it. How do you protect data? How do you protect personal information? How do you ensure safety? How do you deliver informed consent? Where do you go for moderation? And the Guardian were great this morning. But you know what? Post-moderation is no good when you've broken someone's heart, when you've terrorised them through saying something that they know is going to destroy their lives. When you begin to assassinate someone's character in that online environment, deleting it later, do you know what? That's just not good enough. That's just not good enough. If you really want to have the best standards possible, pre-moderate, don't post-moderate. And if the reason you don't pre-moderate is because of cost, then you've got to ask yourself, why are you really doing it anyway? Can you afford to do it without moderation if you're simply doing it after the fact? Because you cannot put someone's life back together. Lesson I learned very early on is if you make mistakes when you're dealing with the area of paedophilia, you can't go to someone and say, look, I'm really sorry. I know we arrested you. I know we seized all your computers. I know you've been suspended from work and perhaps you haven't been able to get access to your children. But you can't go and say, you know, you're okay now. Everything's fine. Because your neighbours, there's no offence that has a stigma like it. No offence. So it's about thinking. It's about balancing. And you know, when Facebook and Google were in today, I did sit and reflect on the fact that they have improved beyond recognition in some points. And when the thing came up about the red button, you know, I had my hand in the air because I thought, I'm not having this. You know, because there was a battle over the button. They called it the panic button. And they flew to the UK to talk to a lot of our charity partners at the time, and CEOC was saying, actually, being able to directly access a one-stop shop where you can then make the decisions rather than the buffet effect of I'll search Google for help, I hope I get the right thing at the right time in the right place. We thought that was a good idea. And I sat down with Elliot Schrag, I think his name is, from Google, and the journalist who's recording me, don't quote the name, because I probably pronounced it wrong. But the bottom line is, I sat down with him and we had this discussion about deterrence. And what I was saying at the time was the button is not about panic. The button was never about 999. It was like the burglar alarm on the front of your house. If you have something which gives you immediate access to the help that you need, whether it's Beat Bullying, whether it's Bullying Alliance, whether it's the Samaritans, whether it's CEOC, provided it is a one-stop shop with immediate access to that information, and the advice that tells you cut and paste this and capture it now because that's best evidence, that's a deterrent. And of course I was told, well, you know, we don't really believe in that concept. I said, do you have a burglar alarm on your house? Because that's deterrent. When you drive along the road from where you are going home, and you see the big painted sign at the side of the road with a camera on it, do you accelerate or do you put your foot in the brake? Personally, I always put my foot in the brake even when I'm not speeding. Because you think, where am I, what am I doing, and what are the consequences likely to be? Educate and empower young people by delivering these type of messages into the classroom. I have seen more people, young people, where the light goes on when they watch a video. A simple 3-minute video that's not got some baldy, overweight, retired police officer like me saying it's dangerous out there. a video that's actually delivered in that, whatever the new style is, and I'm out of touch, not my kids are out of the house. But whether it was the OC or Melrose Place or whatever else, the right music, the right people, the right message, and you engage young people and think, that could be me. That could be me. And when the button was on, and did go on, a report at 6 o'clock on a Sunday night, by 6:15 with local police. Investigation begins, and 3 days later, because a young girl reported her fears for her friend, a man is arrested. A man is arrested online to 30 other children, as police go through the door, to 30 other children. And in the bag of his car, which the friend had seen near a park, there's Viagra, lubricant, condoms, and a knife. Did the police make that interaction? No, they didn't. An empowered child who'd been educated to make the right decision at the right time for one of their friends did that. And that was facilitated. And you know, the truth is this, I don't want to criticise Facebook, because they have come on leaps and bounds. The way you can differentiate, the way you can use the privacy now, is much, much better. The problem is, how many of you knew all those things before you come in today? How many of you understood how simple it is actually to wind back and change, perhaps, the sharing that you had thought was sensible before? Very few. My problem, and the problem I have with people in general, is talk is cheap. Talk is very cheap. We all say the right thing. You can get any audience in, and if you want to kind of, you know, make them like you, you can do it. You tell them how great they are. And the truth is, that's veneer. Doing the right thing is critically more important. So when we look at this, parents say, we haven't got enough information. How can I protect my child? You know, I need more information about it. I did a radio interview this morning before this, talk about what we were doing today, and they said it's just going to be another talking shop, isn't it? And the truth is, I said, I don't think so. If you get the right people in the right place, and they're properly linked, they can go back and make a limited difference. And a limited difference can sometimes save a few. Now, if Facebook and Google were still here, and seriously listening, and seriously participating, you'd make a huge difference. Because the slightest change in policy there has a difference that goes millions upon millions to billions. And it's about how we better engage and take the opportunity with the improvements they've made to build on that. But also that we hold teachers to account and parents to account from the, you know what, we don't know enough. A lady approached me after an event recently saying, yeah, but I don't understand Facebook. I spoke at a conference where I asked the deputy heads responsible for policy to put their hand up if they signed off the social media policy. And they nearly all did. When you ask them to keep their hands up if they actually had a Facebook account, a friend's Reunited account or a Google Plus account, only two did. So 30-something were signing off a policy that they didn't even understand. That's like me saying, you know, I don't know how to drive, but, you know, hey, it'll be okay. Or I don't know how to swim, but I'll teach your children. Are you going to send them to me if I can't do it myself? So it's about being credible. It's about being realistic. And it's about educating children. And where you can give children a real experience, a reflection in real terms of what can happen, in a way that is credible and real, in my experience, they tend to reflect. In my experience, they tend to protect their friends. And the viral nature of that is hugely powerful. Social media is not going away. And thank God, we are going to have to upskill. Those of you that are involved in social care, those of you involved in education, you have to upskill. The world is changing, and you cannot continue to operate with a quill. You have to move ahead. And whilst there's a lot of it, you know, I love my iPad. I don't know what it's for, but I like carrying it around because people think, hey, he's up to speed. You know, and lots of schools take the technology and take the equipment, but actually haven't got a strategy for using them. And one of the things I heard in the workshop this afternoon that rang so true again was involving the young people in the development of the policy that empowers. And if you involve them, you do another thing. You give them a degree of ownership. And where you involve the people upon whom the policy is going to apply, in the creation of that policy, then actually they self-police. Because they understand why you cannot do this, why you cannot do that, why you cannot be a friend if you're a social care provider to a client with special needs. You can't be friends. And you know what? There's part of me that thinks, why not? But actually, the Social Care Council guidelines don't allow it. But perhaps there are other ways of getting around that by thinking laterally about the use of social media, information sharing platforms, information sharing apps that allow people the opportunity to feel that they are united, to feel that they are part of something. So they're getting the information that keeps them informed.
Because all too often in the social care market, this, the service user is someone we do things to, as opposed to do things with, when it comes to technology. So you're probably thinking, well, look, this guy's pretty off beam, you know, and maybe he's lost the plot. And you know what? Maybe I have. But that being said, you know, I've still got the microphone. At the end of the day, leadership, and I'll finish, leadership to me is critically important. And you know, you can talk the talk and you can say what you want. But I believe in the Benjamin Franklin theory, as I said before, better well done than well said. I believe in the Hal Moore from We Were Soldiers Once and Young style, which is leaders like him, and I'm not saying I'm one because I have stepped off, but leaders like him, those people, those social workers, those teachers who go in every day to do a difficult job in difficult circumstances, who are vulnerable to false allegations, who are vulnerable to a sliding scale now in which policy fits and which policy doesn't. You know, will the policy still be the same in 2 years if we get a new government? You know, and I hope we do get a new government as opposed to new policy. I hope that too. He, whenever he was training the young men and women he was sending into Vietnam, he said to them, I can't promise to bring you all back alive, but I promise to bring you all back. And he said, I'll also promise that I'll be the first person to set foot on the battlefield, and I will be the very last to step off. Now, he's a great leader, not because he delivered the rhetoric that anyone who's been on the senior command course could deliver. Anyone can say, I will do this. He was a great leader because he was the first person to set foot in the battlefield and the last person to step off. For those of you that are still in the game, for those of you that are still teaching, for those of you that still have influence with government and policy development, that still have influence, whether it's in the board of governors in schools or with the technology committee or with teacher training, you're still on the field. So be a Hal Moore. Be the person that believes in what you're doing, that wants to leapfrog, that wants to deliver new technology, and deliver it before you become a follower. Because times are changing. And you will either move fast and leapfrog and be someone that people follow, or you will actually be one of the people who say, that's a great idea. I kind of thought of that myself, but I never did. And you'll be copying other people's policies, following other people. Get to the forefront. This has been fantastic today. I've enjoyed every minute of it. I really enjoyed the workshop session that I participated in. I know David's going to give an overview. But all too often, now that I've left, you kind of go off in a world of your own where it's about profit, where it's about how much you're paid for what you do and how you do it. And sometimes for me, it's good to come back into an environment and an audience that reminds you of what it's like when you're actually doing something that truly makes a difference. So I envy you that. And while you have it, or if you have it ahead of you, enjoy it, because before you know, it'll be over. And you'll be some old fart like me standing at the front telling more stories. So thank you very much. Good luck and God bless. Thank you.